The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the topic for today is intimacy. And it's probably a topic which Western Dharma teachers have picked up on quite a bit. Among Western Dharma teachers, especially Zen, they love this. Some of them love this saying that to be, where they equate to be awakened, is to be intimate with all things. And the other thing they like to say in Zen is, not knowing is most intimate. As this, you know, if we know too much and we come with our preconceived ideas, we can't really know what's directly here. And so I think this idea of not knowing is most intimate. And it's an interesting perspective to look at Dharma practice, the idea of intimacy. And I'll talk a little bit first about some of my own experience with this topic. And then I'll say at the heart of the talk some things which are maybe not particularly or specifically Buddhist. And then I'll bring it back to a Buddhist perspective on this topic or the value of it at the end. I think of intimacy as having two major elements, and maybe there's other definitions, and it might be interesting for each of you to consider how you use the term, if it has any value for you, or even if it has no value at all, it probably has some meaning that you give it that gives it no value, or gives it value, or something. And so for me, the intimacy involves two things. It involves knowing something closely, knowing something well, and it involves, in that knowing, not having any barriers in the knowing. Some people might say intimacy involves feeling closely connected, somehow a deep connection with something. And I think that's nice, but I kind of prefer to say with no barriers to the knowing. Because when you talk about being deeply connected, it's too easy, I think, to slide over in, we should be connected. We're supposed to be a certain way. Whereas if they express the idea of no barriers to connection, then whatever's supposed to happen when there's no barriers, no static, nothing gets in the way, then it can happen freely on its own. And who knows what it's supposed to look like? Maybe it doesn't have to look like being deeply connected. So maybe this will make more sense as we go through this. And so for me, discovering some of the value of what I call intimacy probably began most clearly with sitting meditation. That it was in meditation, in Zen meditation specifically, where I started to know myself in deeper and deeper ways and feel a kind of intimacy to myself, to my feelings, my thoughts, my emotions, my kind of inner life, in a way that I'd never known when I was younger. And it felt very rich. It felt very satisfying to be connected, to know. And even if what was being known was not very pleasant, it was still felt very precious to be in touch with it, or to really experience it, to let it be there without any hindrance or any barrier. And it's represented by an experience I had at the Zen monastery at Tassajara. When you first go there to be part of a 3-month intensive practice period of meditation, as is the custom in Japan, there's a ritual, a ceremony, or a rite of passage that you have to pass in order to be able to enter the monastery. And this rite of passage involves sitting in the meditation hall. For when I was there, I think the rule was 5 to 10 days without moving, kind of. Three times a day, you were given a meal, and so you could turn around in your seat because all the meals were eaten in the meditation hall. So that was kind of like you were busy eating, and then after the meal, you had, I think, half an hour break, and then you had to go back and sit. But there were no bells. There were no. You just had to sit until the next meal, And you know, if you really needed to move, you could move. But and if you really needed to go to the bathroom, you could. But you know, the sitting was 5 to 10 days. How long you sat, and it was the custodian of the meditation hall decided how long, or the abbot or someone, who decided how long you sat. And if they saw you going to the bathroom often, or if they saw you kind of fidgeting and moving a lot, it was going to be the longer rather than the shorter. And I did this twice. I had to do it in Japan as well, where in Japan it was, there was 7 to 14 days. And you had to kind of, it was kind of like you had to prove your sincerity in Japan to be entered. So in Japan, first you had to kind of show up at the monastery gates, and then you had to stand out there at the front of the gate, however long it took to prove your sincerity. And you just have to stand there, and stand there, and stand there, and stand there. And at some point, they felt, okay, this person's serious. So we'll let him come in, and now he can go to the first little ante room right next to the main entryway, where he gets a sit for 7 to 14 days. And the same system, you know, after meals, you got a little break, you got to sleep. So this is a long way of saying that it was pretty painful. And, you know, not moving for long periods of time. And when I was at Tassajara, there were three of us doing it together, so we sat together like this in a row. And so in order to cope, I had to really come to terms, be present for the, mostly for me, a lot of leg pain that I had. And so I had to be very, very attentive to what was going on to be able to manage with the pain so that fear, aversion, despair, self-pity, all these things didn't get the upper hand. And I learned quickly that if I had something like these things, like self-pity, that the muscles around my knee would ever so slightly contract and it would hurt more. And if I had no self-pity, it wouldn't hurt as bad. So I preferred not hurting so bad. So I had to watch what was going on in my mind very carefully. And I saw that what I thought about affected my relationship to the pain, affected how much at ease I could be with it or dis-ease I had with it. So it was so long, you know, 5 to 10 days, that tracking it, being with it, and having to be meticulous with watching my mind in order to, for me, it felt like to survive, that I never had been so closely in touch with myself. It was so, I didn't know how long it was going to be. It was open-ended, and up to, I guess, 10 days. And at some point, I was sitting there in the meditation hall, and I felt these fingers tapping me on the back of my shoulder. And I knew it was over. And I started crying because what I thought was, I'll never be this intimate with myself ever again. Because who would put themselves through that on purpose? And so I, and this idea of, you know, being really intimate. So what I discovered, though, is that you don't have to sit in pain to have that intimacy. It was just that was my, you know, first encounter with it. And as my meditation practice deepened and continued, I learned to be a little more meticulous in being present. In the meticulousness of it, all, you know, it's kind of like the door is open or the window is open to see. And so I could see all the little movements of my mind. I could see the movements of my emotions and feelings. And as I got quieter and stiller, it was more and more intimate, more detailed, more kind of felt closer, deeper in to what was going on. And it felt so good to be deeply in touch with myself. And as I did that, what I felt was that what I saw was the forces that I would come up in me where I would lose that, where I would start thinking about things or reacting to things or kind of getting involved with my preferences or my dislikes of things. And then I could actually feel how I left that intimacy or that close connectivity. And that was a powerful teacher for me, to watch what goes on in the mind to do that. And the more I knew how to be at ease and it was deep knowing and at peace with myself, the more that became a teacher for me to see and notice how I reacted to that and pulled away from it or whatever went on. So then the other thing that happened in those Zen days was we would sometimes sit for, see, seven-day retreats, and we would sit in the meditation hall for 7 days. And we would, in Zen, you sit very, you know, and kind of very, it's very organized. And I would sit next to some people who were just, you know, just a couple inches, knees were just maybe 2 or 3 inches apart. So we were sitting pretty close to each other. We were all sitting in a row facing the wall. And in Zen, they meditate with the eyes open. So you know, your visual field, you're not really focused looking at anything, but still the visual field is kind of present. And what I started to discover was sitting next to someone for 7 days, I would be aware, without thinking about it or trying to, of their breathing. I'd be aware of their chest moving. Outside of my eyes, I could see their chest moving or their belly moving, and I could see how they sat. I could see when they started feeling, you could feel or see in their body, and the body shifts and stuff. Oh, now they're struggling, they're having a hard time, or now they're crying, or now they're really clear and present, and boy, they're really still now. And but especially with the breathing, I felt such intimacy with those people. I felt like I really got to know people in a way that, 7 days sitting next to them in silence, I felt I knew them better than if I'd spent 7 days talking to them. Because talking, you learn something about people, but there's something deeper about meditating with someone. There's like somehow they're touching into deeper parts of themselves or fuller parts of themselves, and somehow it's kind of manifesting, or somehow, you know, there was not less barriers for me to take it in. And so I felt very precious about this kind of, you know, the people I sat next to and taking them in. And it wasn't done intentionally. Maybe if it done intentionally, I wouldn't have been felt so intimate if I was trying to do it. But it came from kind of the openness, the clarity, the subtleness, the presence of sitting there. And so this was very nice. And then and one of the great insights I had periodically through my time of being a meditator is that my mind, is essentially the same mind in meditation and outside of meditation. The inner life that I have is, it's the same inner life I carry with me everywhere, in a sense. And so to have a higher quality mind or heart or inner life in meditation and not have it outside of meditation is to live an arbitrary line. It's to live kind of a divided line. And it became very clear to me, why should I have this freedom? Why should I have this intimacy? Why should I have this poignancy and aliveness and integrity that I felt in meditation, why should it remain there? The mind has the same potential to do it outside of meditation. And so that realization was really important for me, because that was the time when I shifted my focus from only doing meditation or thinking meditation where it was at, to trying to discover how to continue or how to have that depth of contact with myself and the world around me, how to have that sense of freedom or intimacy or integrity in the rest of my life as well. And it became a years-long process to discover how to do this. And in fact, that was what motivated me to go live at the Zen Center. Not to do more meditation, but to be in an environment where I felt that I could learn how to extend or discover what I was discovering in meditation in the rest of my life, in work, in conversation with people, in all kinds of different settings. And so that was what motivated me. And then, but because that's where I went, there was a lot of meditation. And as I kept wanting to explore this more and more, it became more important to do this. I would go deeper into the Buddhist world. And as I did that, the consequence was more meditation. So there was this wonderful reciprocal relationship between meditation and then doing more and then being interested in how I did this in life. An important place for me with this intimacy was working in the monastery kitchen. And I learned a lot about how much I was not really present for much of my daily activities in life. I had a lot of preferences. I had things I wanted to do and didn't want to do. I had, important things to think. And so I wasn't really there with chopping the carrots. And the carrots became part of my important monastic teachers. Because I would, spend months chopping vegetables in the kitchen. And I could literally, I was so much didn't want to be there sometimes that I had my body turned around facing the door. And kind of like, and it was kind of chopping kind of the vegetables kind of sideways because, and I would notice how I was and I would turn my body back so just me and the carrot. And I'd notice how my mind, would have all these other thoughts take me away and reactions. And just like sitting with a pain in that rite of passage I described, I wasn't in pain, but I had to kind of really be there with the carrot. I had to know myself well, and not give in to all these kind of ways, byways and highways of the mind, the thoughts, reactions, and just be there with the carrot. And so I became more intimate with myself as chopping vegetables, but I felt then very intimate with the carrot, and that was nice. I mean, maybe that's what did you accomplish in your years of Buddhist practice, Gil? Intimacy with carrots. I don't think that goes, would go very, very popular or something. But the idea is that the carrots represent a lot of different things that can really be present for. And so Zen training was a lot about bringing this presence, attention, and fullness to each thing that you do. And one way of describing that is to be intimate with each thing you do. And so I felt this intimacy and care and attention with the carrots, with washing pots, with sweeping the grounds, with all the things we did. And that was very rich for me to discover. And it was one of the ways to extend what was happening in meditation out into daily life. And then it was also the challenge of people. It's sometimes meditation is a lot easier than being with people, for me. And so what is it to be intimate with people, or what are the barriers that I had to being present in a full way, in a caring way, without any barriers, and just really be there? And so I started to experiment with how I talked with people and what happens as I talk. And am I there really? Is my conversation present for them? Am I present for them? Am I more involved in my reactions, my preferences, my negotiating, trying to fix things, trying to have an impact on them rather than just be present? And I learned a lot about myself that was rather humbling in this regard, in my relationship to people and everything. And slowly I began to let go of the stuff that was kind of not so useful for me to do. One of the first ones that I learned in that kitchen at the monastery was how much I wanted to be liked. And that wasn't the end of it. I noticed how much I was constantly doing social gymnastics so that I would try to get everyone to like me. And I got to see this at a time when I was the kitchen manager. And there's something about being ahead of a kitchen with, there were sometimes, a dozen people working in the kitchen, which is usually not the ideal place to get people to like you. They have to get the job done and, all kinds of things. And they talk about monastery kitchens being kind of a pressure cooker place. And so for me to constantly be doing the social gymnastic as the kitchen manager was very stressful. And so I had to take a deep look at this, and I had to see how attached I was to this. And I learned that desire to be liked interfered with being really present for the person I was with. And in a sense, interfered with intimacy. And I had probably thought that if people liked me, then we could be intimate. But that was just mostly going with my preferences and with this veil of desires that I had. And I had to actually let go of the desire to be liked in order to have something like real intimacy, which maybe is kind of a counterintuitive. So now I want to say, talk a little bit about what I think are three elements of intimacy that maybe have nothing to do with Buddhism, but hopefully have some universal value to point these things out. Or three approaches to intimacy, or three channels in which intimacy occurs. So one of them is feeling really intimate with someone else because you know them well. There are people who will share themselves, who will tell you stories about themselves, people you know, their life story, their situation like that, whatever's going on, or they're going through some kind of difficulty or something wonderful, and you feel really connected to them, you know them well, and you feel like, wow, there's real intimacy here because I know them. And I know, you know, they're telling me all kinds of details of their life, and boy, I'm being pulled in. I really feel close because I know so much about them. And some people feel, you know, quite nice. It really can be rewarding and satisfying to feel that depth of connection to other people. Some places where that can be a little bit dysfunctional, as I think some people know, is that sometimes people are in helping professions like therapists and Dharma teachers. People will come and tell them the deep, intimate, deep personal aspects of their life. And the therapist and Dharma teacher can feel very intimate and feel very connected to other people. But if that's the only place they have intimacy, and they're using that kind of role of being therapist or Dharma teacher for that kind of closeness, that's dysfunctional. That is not so healthy, actually. But, you know, because the intimacy is one way. You know someone else well. That's one way. The other way is they know you well. So the first one is you know them well. The second is someone else knows you well. But it's not just they know you well. To be intimate, I think there has to be a feeling that you are understood, that someone knows you well. The feeling of being known and being understood. So the first one is you understand them and know them. The other feeling of intimacy that you can have is when you feel someone now knows you. Wow, I'm known. And to really feel like you've been seen and understood can be a very satisfying feeling. And a feeling that, and some people crave that, they want that. And some people, that's the only kind of intimacy they know. And so they're not really interested in other people. They just want to share themselves so that they can have the experience of someone who knows them and sees them and experiences them. So to be really known by someone can be very satisfying. And to be known not just because, the surface stuff of what you do, but, you start sharing very personal things of your inner life and what goes on. And someone knows it, and they know it with care, with respect. They know it with sense of it's safe for you for them to know it. They respect what they hear, and you feel that knowing. And then the third approach to intimacy is related to this thing about being intimate with oneself. The channel is to oneself. One really knows oneself well. And one is quiet enough, one doesn't have so much static in their mind that interferes with deeper and deeper knowing and recognizing what's going on. And that's why meditation, the stillness of meditation, is not for the purpose of being still, but so there's no static to see the deeper impulses, feelings, desires, wishes, fears, beliefs that we have. And to really start knowing and feeling deeply can feel certainly very intimate with oneself. One way that intimacy, these different kinds of intimacy, these different approaches or channels for it, they can work together. So sometimes if someone else is... if you're really trying to understand someone else, really trying to be present for someone else, and maybe you have to respond or know what to say or how to support them, what they're going through might be quite difficult. What they're going through is maybe challenging for all kinds of ways. And in order to really be present for them, in order to really connect and understand them, it takes a lot of intimacy with oneself. One has to be able to tune in to one's own feelings, one's own body sensations, one's own beliefs, one's own history and relation, all kinds of things, and really stay in touch with deeper places inside where we resonate with someone or feel connected to someone, or where we take in someone, process someone, than simply our rational mind. You know, we hear the story, and then we just kind of do the calculation. Well, they said they had a flat tire, and I had a flat tire once, and they probably feel, you know, a little bit discouraged. Now I know them. But, you know, it takes much more to kind of tune in and to feel. And the greater capacity we have for sensing and feeling in ourselves, the deeper we can feel and sense the fullness of someone else. And so some people, what they value in connection to other people, talking with other people, connecting with other people, is not necessarily being intimate with them, but the process by which they feel intimate with themselves in that approach. And that can be a little bit dysfunctional, that if that's the only way someone knows how to be intimate with themselves, is in the with a prompt or the intensity that can happen with when we're with someone else, and only then do we really know ourselves. So these are three different approaches to, or channels for, feeling intimacy. Some people only know intimacy through one or two of these channels. I think it's ideal to know them through all three, because then the doors of knowing, of awareness, is equally open in all directions. So three approaches are to be intimate by knowing someone else well, to feel intimacy by feeling you have been known by someone else well, you are being known, and then the intimacy that comes from knowing yourself well. So three ways. So what's the Buddhist kind of approach or Buddhist practice kind of thing to do with these three different things? I think what makes it really rich is in Buddhist practice, we're looking at the heart of Buddhism is how to be free. How to be free of attachments, clinging, resistance. How to be free of the static or the barriers we have to being intimate, but the barriers we have to being free. And so if we use the deeper intimacy that we experience as the material for the practice, then we're going to learn places in a deep, the more we know ourselves, we're going to recognize, oh, here I'm stuck, here I'm being reactive, here I'm resisting, here my preferences are operating, here I have a lot of desires, here I have a desire for intimacy, and lo and behold, the desire for intimacy is now interfering with being intimate. Here I have a desire to run away or to not be known, to protect myself. Do I really need to do that? What is that? What's going on here in me? And to really feel and understand what's going on in this deeper, deeper way. And so the process of being intimate is not for intimacy's sake, but for the sake of freedom. And then to discover greater and greater ease. And to do that in relationship to other people is a fascinating process. And not always welcomed by other people. Because as people get to know each other deeply, kind of what we call maybe deep or very close relationships are often driven by a lot of attachment. I think that it's probably hard to find a relationship where we don't have attachment to certain preferences, our desires, what we want, what we don't want. And sometimes the more intimate people are, in terms of being closely connected, partnered in some way, probably the more subtle, deeper the expectations, the attachments that we have are operating. And so intimacy by itself it doesn't always come attachment-free. In fact, sometimes what people are intimate about is they're intimate because they share the same attachment. And that can feel very safe, it can feel very connected, it can feel like they know each other well, and let's just keep doing it. Whereas to begin discovering how to be free and not try to get everyone to like one yourself, or not try to get something from a relationship, or not try to get approval, or even get love, or status, or safety, or recognition, or pleasure, or whatever it might be, but to stay open and to meet someone else in the openness and to be able to be met by someone else in that freedom and that openness is one of the great, I think, delights of Buddhist practice. In the Zen tradition where I practiced first, that ability to meet another practitioner, mind to mind or heart to heart, body to body in a sense, in that field of freedom is considered to be ideal. And in fact, what they're doing sometimes in Zen practice is they're using that as the orientation or a reference point for discovering how free you can be. Because it's possible to be free or feel free in a limited way, but in meditation or alone, and think that I'm really free. But it's not, you know, but then you run into people and you discover you're not so free. It's not a few people who spend long periods of time on meditation retreats or off being monastic or something and protected from many of the everyday concerns. And they thought, I'm pretty free. And then they come back to the city and work and, you know, and start a family and getting the kids to school and the mortgage and then the plumbing under the sink starts leaking. And it goes on, you know. Jack Kornfield tells a wonderful story of meeting one of the famous Sufi masters who's living here in the West, Idri Shah or someone like that. And he said something like, you take almost any of the great spiritual masters from Asia and who seem so wonderfully enlightened, and you put them in an American suburb with kids and a dog and work and a mortgage, and they're going to be challenged. So the work of bringing the practice to our relationships and discovering how to have this freedom and clarity and no barriers and a certain kind of intimacy is also part of the work that they explicitly do in some schools of Zen. And they have this wonderful saying, and little like a phrase they say, a cliche, only between a Buddha and a Buddha. That something about the nature of practice can only happen in relationship to other people. And so when you go to a Zen teacher for a formal interview, meeting, one-on-one, at some point, it stops becoming a place you go for advice, but it's a place you go to meet, to discover what it is to meet from the place of the depth of your practice. And you show up and you kind of be your practice, and the teacher hopefully bees her practice, and then, you know, what happens and what kind of meeting happens there? Is it static free? Is it attachment free, or what happens there? So this idea of discovering intimacy and exploring intimacy can be very satisfying, but I think it's a great help for Buddhist practice. And to do Buddhist practice and explore how to become freer and freer in our relationships and in this intimacy is also a way of purifying our intimacy, clarifying it, and also making it safer and safer. I think it's fair to say that there's a lot of attachment, as I said, in relationships, even ones that feel very intimate. And those can blow up at some point. People can go together for a long time, and then these attachments get the upper hand, or they manifest in ways that are difficult for the relationship. But if the intimacy we feel is used as a field of practice, of looking at the static, looking at the attachments, looking at what's really going on deeper and deeper and deeper, and smelling our way, feeling our way to the greater freedom, then the process of intimacy is protected and made safer as well. So it's a wonderful reciprocal relationship, that intimacy supports the practice, and the practice supports the intimacy. So if this is interesting for you, what I said, what I'm hoping from this talk is not to have taught you something, but rather to have provoked something in you. And what I provoke is that you reflect on your own relationship to intimacy. How do you understand it? What's your relationship to it? Does it have any role in your life? How does it work for you? Are these three different principles of three different kinds of intimacy I talked about, are they interesting for you? Do you fall in one of these three more than the other? Your intimacy you tend to feel with people tend to be more about knowing them, or are they knowing you, or is mostly knowing yourself? How does this work for you? So, intimacy. I hope this is interesting. So, not to frighten you, because intimacy can be quite frightening. So you don't have to be intimate whatsoever. But before the potluck, we have about 5 minutes, it would be great if you would turn to one or two people next to you and to say hello and say your name. And is that as far as you want to go? Great. But you might want to say something safe about this theme today to the people you're saying hello to. Anything that was evocative for you, interesting for you, or challenging you'd like to just say. And then please stay for the potluck, which will probably start in about 10 minutes. And thank you for being here.